And I'm going to inherit a rather splendid set, I think, of PowerPoint slides. So thank you, John. So I intend to take a slightly topsy-turvy approach to this evening because John and Sally have looked forward. And I intend tonight to look largely backwards. Though what I'm going to do is give some glimpses of my strategic priorities as I enter the role of GCSA after John's very distinguished tenure. It's important to learn from history, and we should remember a quote which is oft paraphrased from the Spanish philosopher George Santayana: those who can't remember history are doomed to repeat it. So Solly Zuckerman, who was the first GCSA, was quite a prolific writer, and he collected a fascinating collection of speeches and essays into a volume entitled Scientists and War, The Impact of Science on Military and Civil Affairs. And this volume arrived in my office at the Wellcome Trust in an envelope from one of my previous colleagues, John Stewart, and I'm very pleased to report, in a spirit of sustainability, that the book had been gift-aided to a charity shop from where John rescued it to benefit the next GCSA. And ironically, the book plate in it quoted Pope, "A little learning is a dangerous thing." Zuckerman himself often emphasized the importance of the moral neutrality of science. And he described science, and I don't think anyone here will have any difficulty with this definition, as the exact body of knowledge which is always being added to by scientists through controlled and reproducible observations. And of course, he noted that pure science frequently turns out to be basic to some practical development, to some piece of applied science, or to some convention of thought, which then starts transforming the environment in which it was distilled. And of course, that is a point that constantly needs to be reinforced to those that fund basic science. But I think that moral neutrality of science is the stake in the ground that actually provides the anchor for the scientific advisor. Our job is actually to advise politicians on the science, but David, it's for politicians to actually ultimately make the policy decisions that flow from that scientific advice. And of course, that advice is often provided in the context of conflicting policy objectives that go beyond the science itself. So one example I'll pick would be the criminal justice system, where there are three objectives. The first, of course, is to prevent reoffending. The second is to stop others, to deter others from offending. And the third, of course, is to provide retribution. Now, science, so through, for example, controlled experimental approaches to sentencing, can help with the first of these objectives, and to some extent it can probably help with the second. But on the third, it can't help. And so I think the general point is that politicians will often have to frame scientific advice within a broader context. And thinking about energy, which obviously is an enormously important topic for all of us, there are three prisms through which I think one has to view energy. One of these is price. The second is energy security. And the third is the sustainability of the environment and the planet. And it's balancing what can be conflicting policy objectives that causes the greatest difficulty. So I think that everyone here will agree that this is a crucial time for science, engineering, and technology in society, and I think this quote encapsulates it well. Whilst it's always been important to satisfy public opinion that science is worthwhile in each of its aspects, cultural, social, and economic, the scale of the resources devoted to science now makes this absolutely necessary if science is to continue to have the resources it needs. Ironically, this problem may be the more pressing because the nation is at last genuinely aware that our economic future rests upon advanced technology, which itself depends on science for its fundamental concepts. This quote comes from a Council for Scientific Policy report of 1966. Plus ça change. And in 1960, Zuckerman wrote, "This is the age of scientific policy. We in the United Kingdom have our Council on Scientific Policy, our university grants committee, our research councils, and our 50 or so research associations in which industry and government combine to see what scientific knowledge can be transformed into industrial technology, and so into greater productivity and wealth. And I think he would be reassured that we still have this planning machinery, albeit that CSP is now CST, and UGC is now HEFCE and HEFCE Wales, etc. And of course, the challenge, which was now as then, is about collaboration, it's about coordination, it's about interdisciplinarity. And I think one of the biggest challenges is it's about effective execution. And I think this is a challenge for all of us. And leadership, of course, is about deciding where to go, but the real challenge is often not where to go, it's how to get there. And I think that is the challenge of turning policies and executing them effectively. And I think it's a challenge for all of us. I want to recommend another book now, which Douglas Kell drew my attention to. And that's a book called The Struggles of Albert Woods. And this was written by William Cooper in 1952. And I can just see a few nods in the audience. So William Cooper was actually a pseudonym for Harry Hoff, who was a student and later a close friend of C.P. Snow. And it's a wonderful tale of academic progression from a lower middle class working background through the halls of the chemistry department in Oxford to the halls of Whitehall. And I thoroughly recommend it. It sticks a wonderfully sharp pin in the balloon of scientific pomposity. And it actually shows us that both the worlds of academia and public administration have not really changed very much in the last 60 years or so. And of course, if you want to go back to 1908, Microcosmographia Academica is the perfect textbook primer for any aspiring politician. Hoff himself was actually an interesting man. In 1958, he became the personnel consultant to the United Kingdom Atomic Energy Authority, and his chief contribution, according to the Dictionary of National Biography, was the masterminding of an annual North American recruitment campaign, which came to be known as the Hoff Board. And it was designed to reverse the brain drain of the country's scientific talent by matching the abilities of returning scientists to the demands of the scheme-sponsoring laboratories. And I have to say, and I don't think there will be any doubt in this audience, that the free movement of scientists, engineers, and technologists remains a key policy issue. So, John, what have I learnt from you? I've been known to jokingly characterise your tenure as bounded by ashes to ashes. The volcanic ash cloud, as you illustrated to us, and latterly, ash trees. And speaking to your son, it may be ashes to ashes to ashes, because I gather that you plan to spend at least some of your future at the Oval and Lords. So I do slightly wonder whether my tenure will be dust to dust. And you can speculate what might happen. But John, you've been absolutely superb at getting excellent advice in really very urgent situations. And the use of SAGE, the Scientific Advice Group in Emergencies, and I think you've effectively embedded SAGE in the government's civil contingencies procedures. I think your role in the Japanese earthquake and the overwhelming of Fukushima by the tsunami is a wonderful exemplar of your leadership as government chief scientific advisor. And I think it illustrates importantly something that I think is neglected, which is the role of science in international diplomacy. So you and your colleagues rapidly assembled a team of talented individuals from different environments and disciplines. And of course, I think that's one of the real challenges for the GCSA. It's about distilling the advice from many others and finding the right people very quickly. But important in that situation, the UK advice to UK citizens in Japan, supported by our politicians, was actually different from that of other countries. And I was going to mention a country not very far away by Eurostar, but it's been mentioned once, so I won't. And your measured and rigorous approach has actually created enormous goodwill in Japan. And you've followed that up. You've supported the Japanese in reassessing their nuclear regulatory framework and in rebuilding their community safely. And I think it's fair to say that your work has strengthened the overall relationship between the UK and Japan, which is a key research, investment, and trade partner for the United Kingdom. And I think it you could make the proposition that actually your actions have helped the environment in which it made it more likely that Hitachi would bid, as they did for the UK nuclear programme. So I think it's one thing to respond to emergencies. It's another to do it in a way that actually leaves us better off for dealing with future risks. And again, John, you've extended a scientific approach to even tougher areas of uncertainty. You've initiated the so-called Black Swan Blackett reviews. And your work has improved the science quality in the National Risk Register. And indeed, it'll be a pleasure also to work with my close friend, Sally, who's added another risk to the risk register, as you've heard, in the context of antibiotic resistance. You've reached out to get the best science wherever it is, the learned academies and beyond. And I think that, again, the example of the report from the Royal Society and the Royal Academy of Engineering on hydraulically fractured shale gas generation has been extremely important, and I hope it's advice that I'll be able to take advantage of in the future. So, of course, work like that requires great care. It requires a rather precise definition of the boundaries of the problem. And one, of course, the issues is, and I know this from my long career in academia, that you ask an academic one question and he or she tells you that actually that's not the question you want the answer to, it's another one. But actually, I think that we do have to agree what the question is going to be and what the boundaries were. And whilst I think it was tempting to ask to get a report on the whole of UK energy policy, it was the fact that that report was well-bounded and focused on the question that was asked that made it so important and so valuable. Partnership with business is also key, and you showed through your computer trading report that, of course, a lot of the people that work on those very sophisticated algorithms that allow computers to trade even faster than humans can, faster than their synapses can transmit, actually. A lot of the experts here are, of course, in the private sector. And we mustn't neglect getting advice from the best sources wherever they are. You've done much more, John. You've overseen the re-energising of the Council of Science and Technology, and that now has a much larger business community. And you've built a very effective network of scientists, both inside and outside government. And on the subject of resilience, security, and well-being, and I can tell you they will continue to be key themes for the Government Office of Science, you've shown tremendous leadership, and I will read a quote from you, which is, "There is an intrinsic link between the challenge we face to ensure food security through the 21st century and other global issues, most notably climate change, population growth, and the need to sustainably manage the world's rapidly growing demand for energy and water." And you picked very good words. This threatens to create a perfect storm of global events. Science and technology can make a major contribution by providing practical solutions. And I think, as you've illustrated today, this is a challenge to all of us. But it provides great opportunities as well as dealing with the threats themselves. So I'm going to look back just once more about what history teaches us of the broader roles of the scientist. And Sir John Kendrew is a rather splendid example, a very great scientist who had a terrific argument with the then secretary of the MRC, Sir Harold Hemsworth, who actually stopped him from appearing on a BBC programme. And in 1962, he wrote to Harold Hemsworth, "I simply cannot see why a council employee should not speak publicly on government policy towards universities or the financing and organisation of research generally." And I'm looking at David at this point. And it seems to me that letters to newspapers, articles, and television programs all lie within the same definitions. You may argue that they're not the most effective ways of getting something done, and that these matters are better arranged in the manner of the civil service behind closed doors of ministers or the Athenaeum. And this may often be true, though if one feels strongly about some problems, as I do about the emigration of scientists and the support accorded to research in this country, to the point of feeling that the present situation is little short of disastrous, one may conclude that all methods should be tried, including the mobilisation of public opinion by way of the press and the BBC. But I want to make a broader point, because that generation of Cambridge molecular biologists did not only work at the bench and win their Nobel Prizes. They created a new journal for a new discipline. They presented their work in the media. They sat on government committees. They created new institutions. They created the European Molecular Biology Laboratory. They were responsible for creation of the Wellcome Trust Sanger Institute. They established commercial links. And the technologies which were established in the Laboratory for Molecular Biology were commercially produced. They trained, they imported, they exported scientists. The models they made of molecules played a crucial role in the public presentation of science. So our modern world is shaped by science, engineering, and technology. And our environment is challenged as never before. And I think it's the responsibility of scientists to contribute in many ways, as did those scientists in the Laboratory for Molecular Biology. So tonight is the opportunity for all of us to thank you, John, for your wide range of huge contributions as the Government Chief Scientific Advisor. And I would just end by asking all of you to thank John and to help me as I take on this very challenging role of following in John's footsteps. Thank you.